proceed to the third case of the day, Thomas versus H&R Block. Mr. Weldy?
Good morning, Your Honors. First, let me apologize in advance. I'm getting over a head cold and an ear infection. I haven't had one of those for a couple of decades. So this ear is a little plugged up, and so if I ask any of you to repeat yourself, I'm not trying to be troublesome. I just can't hear you this morning. So we're here this morning to discuss an issue under Indiana law involving whether or not a certain type of compensation does or does not constitute a wage. Ms. Thomas and the proposed class are seeking statutory damages for the failure of H&R Block to pay their end-of-season compensation in compliance with Indiana's 10-day rule. There's no question that the end-of-season compensation was paid in violation of the 10-day rule, as these monies were paid 5 days late in 2006, 7 days late in 2007, and 10 days late in 2008. Rather, the only question before this court is whether or not this particular type of compensation constitutes a wage under Indiana law. The end-of-season compensation is composed of five components. There is a flat fee commission for selling certain products offered by H&R Block. There's also a flat fee commission for completing an individual's tax return. There's a flat fee commission for each returning client that the tax preparer has come back to have their tax returns done on each year they've been a client. And there's also a flat fee commission for each tax preparation service performed based upon the experience of the particular tax preparer. And finally, there's a flat fee commission for each tax preparation service performed based upon the level of training and education of the particular taxpayer.
Now, it also depends on the gross annual, the gross hourly wage. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The way it works is they take all those different flat fee commissions that I just listed off, and those are all added up in the aggregate for the entire tax season, which typically the season would start to run sometime in December of the previous year through mid-April of that year. So the first example would be December of 05 through mid-April of 06. All those different flat fee commissions would be added up. And then subtracted from that would be the hourly wages that H&R Block had actually paid the employees. Not all of the hourly wages, but the vast majority of them, the distinction of which is really kind of meaningless for our discussion here, but it's in the briefs.
You can't arrive at that figure until the season is over, am I correct?
That's correct. That's the way they had it set up, is that they were going to subtract out the vast majority of the hourly wages that were being paid to the employees throughout the season. So you couldn't come up with...
You have to wait till you figure out what the employee made in that last, on its last paycheck.
Correct, Your
Honor. And then you have to do the subtraction function, come up with the figure. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. You're absolutely correct.
Thank you.
And there's this whole question of whether or not those hourly wages are a true hourly wage, or whether in fact they are a draw based upon these aggregate amount of commissions. And the reason for that issue, Your Honor, is because in determining what the hourly wage of a particular employee should be, particularly one that's returning who's worked there before, the general rule of thumb is that they take 80% of what the aggregate of all the commissions were in the previous year and work that out for an hourly wage. Now, that's just a rule of thumb. It's not necessarily exactly what's done at all times.
So I want to make sure I understand that.
Sure.
An employee who returns for a second tax year is assigned an hourly wage. Does that hourly wage reflect the fact that this is the person's second year, not the person's first year?
I would answer that question only to the extent that what I was told when we did the Rule 30B6 deposition was that in determining the hourly wage for an employee coming back for their second or whatever third, fourth year it might be, that they generally look at what the aggregate amount of all the commissions earned during the previous year was, and they take 80% of that. That's just a general rule of thumb. It's not a hard and fast rule. I don't want to misconstrue it to the court.
So a person who had a good first year is going to be making more per hour the second year.
That would generally be correct, Your Honor. And I would think that if for some reason their third year was for some reason a little less, if they did follow that rule of thumb, then perhaps their hourly wage could go down. But I don't have any. We haven't seen anybody's hourly wages beyond Ms. Thomas, so I don't have any examples I can specifically give this court either way or not along those lines.
This extra pay was totally based on a contingency, wasn't it? I mean, there had to be some profit, some plus number, and if it was a negative number, then there wouldn't be any additional pay at the end of the season, would there?
Well, I wouldn't use the word profit, Your Honor, no. But I mean, I would say that yes. If an employee received more in hourly wages than what they earn from the aggregate of all the commission wages that they earn throughout the tax season, then they were not entitled to any end-of-season compensation because they had, in effect, been paid all those monies through their hourly wages, which is why we argued and why we asked the Rule 30b-6 deponent, are these hourly wages not a draw? And on several occasions, the opponent said, yes, they are a draw. Because in essence, they're trying to, they're setting the hourly wages based upon what they believe the commissions are going to be for that employee. And then they're simply prepaying. The rule of thumb would be 80% of those.
But the hourly wages were set on what the employee made the previous year.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the thinking of H&R Block in that regard would be, obviously, that's a good indication as to what we believe the employee is going to do the coming year as well. So if we want to have the vast majority of these commissions being paid throughout the year as a draw on these commissions, then we can set the hourly rate based upon that and simply have, leave a, 20% of whatever it might be at the end of the year, that if they for some reason have a worse year, well, then they're not going to pay out too much. And if they have a good year, well, then they'll be entitled to the end of season compensation that we're discussing here.
And follow up to Judge Evans' inquiry about the contingency. Your opponent makes the point that these payments were really contingent on client payment.
Your Honor, I'm not aware.
What do you say to that?
I'm not aware of any sale that's not contingent on client payment. I've never heard somebody being paid a commission for an attempted sale. They're always paid a commission for a sale actually made and paid for. I don't think it's a contingency on. I don't think payment's a contingency as to whether or not this is a wage. I think payment is a contingency on whether or not the commission's even earned. It's actually something much more basic. You don't actually earn a commission until a sale's been made and paid for. And the example we give is in the J Squared versus Herndon case, which I believe was decided in 05. If it's 04 or 05, I apologize for not remembering the year off the top of my head. In that case, we were dealing with a gentleman who was selling furniture, and he specifically, you made the sale. It was furniture being sold to universities, so these were large orders being made. Made the sale, then the product had to be delivered, and then the product all had to be paid for before his commission was ever earned. And there was never a question that the commissions in that case were in fact wages under Indiana law. So the finding of the district court that payment is a contingency that's relevant, we wholeheartedly disagree with. We think that payment is a requirement, a prerequisite for earning the commission. You can't have a commission until you have payment. And as such, there's no way that it's then a further contingency on whether or not it's actually a wage. And, Your Honor, just to go back even further, the definition, the statutory definition of a wage was adopted by the General Assembly when they passed the wage claim statute in 1939. And in that definition, they specifically listed commissions and task-based compensation and the such. And it's our feeling that if the General Assembly intended for something like payment to be a contingency, well, then it would have been much clearer from their definition. However, if you simply read the definition, there's absolutely no reason to believe that this is a contingency based upon the plain language of the statute. It's our position that each of the components, each of these five different components, if you look at them individually, are a type of wage underneath the statutory definition I just mentioned, which is at Indiana Code 22-2-9-1. And I'll read that definition, and I quote, all amounts at which the labor or service rendered is recompensed, whether the amount is fixed or ascertained on a time, task, piece, or commission basis, or in any other method of calculating such payment. And given that each of the components is a flat fee based upon the sale of a product or a service or the performance of a task, we feel that there's no question that each component is, in fact, a wage as a commission-based or task-based compensation. To date, the Indiana Supreme Court has not heard a case concerning whether commissions or task-based compensation are wages under Indiana law. Rather, to date, the Indiana Supreme Court has only heard one case where they had to determine whether or not a particular type of compensation was a wage. And that case is the High House versus Midwest Orthopedic Institute case.
This brings up, since you mentioned the Supreme Court of Indiana, why don't we certify this and give them a chance?
Your Honor, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that even though I disagree with Judge Hamilton's opinion below, I believe that Judge Hamilton was right, and I quoted four different statements that he made throughout his opinion, that right now, based upon the fact that we only have one Supreme Court decision involving a bonus, and that's it, and there are an array of Court of Appeals cases, however, these Court of Appeals cases are confused and contradictory. And these aren't just my words. These are the words of Judge Hamilton, and he pointed out some of those contradictions. And so I wholeheartedly believe that this case would absolutely be ripe to send to the Supreme Court so that they can help sort out some of this confusion and contradiction that has occurred over the last several years in the different opinions that the Court of Appeals has issued. Many of those opinions are my own, so I'm quite happy to have the Supreme Court weigh in on these issues so we can start trying to have a better idea so that practitioners and lower courts can address these cases and understand how we're supposed to evaluate these cases when determining what's a wage. And this case is rather unique because, we feel that these are obviously commissions, and we've asked the court to find that. But Judge Hamilton felt that he couldn't describe these as either commissions or a bonus. And so, in this situation, what do you look at? Do you look at each of the five components and make a determination as to being a commission or bonus based upon those components? Or do you do as H&R Block is asking and look at how it's paid out and make the determination? We've never had a case like this in front of Indiana Appellate Court. So this would be a great case to go so we can get some guidance on the application of the wage definition in general and for the thousands of people that it would affect in this particular case.
And was Prime Mortgage your case?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Was Grass your case?
I'm sorry?
Grass?
Grass, no, it was not, Your Honor.
In these more recent cases, was there a review sought to the Indiana Supreme Court?
Your Honor, my most recent case that deals with the definition of wages was the McCausland case, and I did ask for petition to transfer in that case. That case dealt with managerial bonuses and managerial commissions, so it's really not completely applicable here. I thought that if the Supreme Court did take transfer, that there were some things that they could say that would be beneficial in helping to sort this out, simply because it's only the second time the Supreme Court would have ever issued an opinion involving the definition of wages. I can't speak for those other cases, to be honest, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I forget. Does this mean I'm running into my rebuttal time?
It's your time, but it's the start of rebuttal, Mr.
Okay.
Bradley.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court? Mr. Weldy correctly stated that the sole issue here to be determined is whether the end-of-season compensation that H&R Block paid to Ms. Thomas constitutes wages within the meaning of the Indiana Wage Payment Statute. The district court properly found that the payment is not wages, and the district court's decision should be affirmed. The facts in this case are undisputed. Ms. Thomas was a seasonal employee who prepared tax returns and sold financial services products. She was employed pursuant to an employment agreement which provided for pay at regular hourly rate. She was paid biweekly throughout the entire tax season, including the final pay period. So she was paid her regular hourly wages within the time constraints of the Indiana law. In addition to her regular wages, she entered into a compensation agreement with H&R Block, a compensation information sheet, which is attached to the party's briefs, in which it was described that she would be eligible for additional end-of-season pay. The end-of-season pay is a one-time payment based on a complicated calculation which takes into account the employee's total hours worked and regular wages paid during the tax season, and also the fees collected by the company for the various services and products sold by the employee. Only if the collections for those services and products exceed the amount of the regular wages that the employee has been paid throughout the tax season is the employee entitled to end-of-season pay. So, therefore, it is in addition to what the employee is paid.
Each of those factors seem to be very task-based. Why is that relevant and probative as to whether or not they're really simply wages?
They are task-based, but there is no right to payment until the customer pays for them. And only if the customer pays for them is that set-off done at the end of the tax season. And the calculation that's done at the end of the tax season includes services sold and collections throughout the 4 or 5 month tax season.
What I'm having a hard time appreciating why it takes extra time to compute this once you have the employee's gross wages for that year. I mean, and you folks have computers. When you pay the person his last check, why can't you pay him this also as well?
The final pay period of the tax season closed on or about April 20th, 21st in 2006 and 2007. Within 5 days of the close of the final pay period, H&R Block is able to calculate the final pay for that period. Now, the final pay is a component of the end-of-season pay calculation. So it takes at least 5 days to get what the company needs, the final pay numbers, in order to calculate the end-of-season pay. Once the pay is available, it immediately starts being fed into the financial information network, the company's overarching information system that is used to calculate the end-of-season pay. And then additional information, direct feeds for clicks and mortar, the other components of the end-of-season pay that are more fully explained in detail in the briefs. Once all of that information is loaded into the system, there's actually a manual checking that goes on. District managers verify the individual components of the pay for the employees under their supervision. It's a massive endeavor, which has many checks and balances. Even after the district managers verify the numbers, then there is a central verification at the world headquarters. And at the end of that time, which is really a matter of days, the end-of-season pay is finally computed, and the reports are sent to the individual employees for what they're going to make. So despite this massive endeavor, H&R Block is still able to pay the employees their end-of-season pay if they're eligible within 13 days in 2006 and 15 days in 2007 of the final pay period.
How do you feel about certification?
We don't think that's necessary. The Indiana Supreme Court has spoken in the High House case. This case does not present any novel issues. The court has to look at the facts of each case individually. So this case would not allow the Indiana Supreme Court to provide any far-reaching rules that would have precedential effect. In addition, the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court declined review of the McCausland case, which did involve whether or not bonuses and commissions were wages under the Indiana law. The fact that they declined that case indicates that they feel that they have spoken and provided enough guidance. The district court found that for four primary reasons, the end-of-season compensation at issue here was not a wage. And I would emphasize those, that it is in addition to the regular hourly wages that the tax professionals receive. It is linked to a contingency, as we've discussed, the contingency of collections by the company for the services and products sold by the tax professional. But it is not calculatable within 10 days, as I've described. It is a time-consuming and detailed process, which, despite the all-consuming nature, is done within a brief period of time. And then finally, the fact that the end-of-season compensation is calculated once per year based on activities during the entire tax season. I would like to address the fact that appellant seeks to characterize the end-of-season compensation as a commission solely because that word is found in the definition of wages in the Indiana Wage Claim Statute. But Indiana courts, in the High House case and in other decisions, have held that you have to look at the substance of the payment, that the name or label is not determinative. And that's true, as indicated by the decisions in which a commission was found not to be a wage and a bonus was found to be a wage. As I mentioned before, in this case, the end-of-season compensation is not paid for pay for time work because it's in addition to the employee's regular wages. As in the Degani case, which is cited by H&R Block in the briefs, an employee could work full-time for the entire tax season and sell these products and still get no end-of-season pay because that set-off hasn't happened yet. And only if the collections from the products exceed the regular hours, the regular wages for the hours worked, would they be entitled to the end-of-season pay. In addition, appellant seeks to characterize the end-of-season pay as a draw on commission. But as the district court found, that's not the situation here. The corporate representative may have used that term for lack of a better description of the offset that takes place at the end of the season. But we know here that if the employee didn't earn enough in end-of-season compensation, there is no requirement that the employee pay back any overage in the wages. In addition, it's undisputed that that the employee spends time doing things and is paid for those things, like attending meetings or attending training sessions. And those hours, even though they're part of the regular pay that the employee receives, are not part of the end-of-season calculation.
They are paid at the same rate as the employee's tax preparation activities?
Yes, yes. I've already mentioned that the end-of-season pay is linked to the contingency of collections, but it's also linked to that the ultimate contingency of setting off what has been paid in hourly wages and what has been collected by the company. Thus, in that instance, that the end-of-season compensation is not for hours worked by the employee, but also it can't be calculated until after the final pay has been calculated, which brings us to the third point, which is that it can't be calculated within the 10 days. And that's what we discussed earlier. Um, The final point that I wanted to make is the fact that the calculation is done only once at the end of the tax season, and it is for based on information and wages accumulated throughout the tax season. And while it is true that the parties can't contract around the law, the 10-day rule, the fact that the compensation information sheets agreed to by the parties do state that the payment will be made outside that 10-day period is relevant to the parties' understanding of whether or not this payment is a wage, and also the difficulty in calculating it. And in this instance, Ms. Thomas's 2006 compensation information sheet said that H&R Block would make payment of the end-of-season pay by May 12th, and payment was actually made May 10th. In 2007, the compensation sheet said the payment would be made May 14th, and it was actually made May 11th. So in both years, H&R Block calculated and paid the end-of-season pay to Ms. Thomas even earlier than they had promised in the compensation information sheet.
You know, as long as there's a pause here, I'll ask a question.
Thank you.
There's like 80,000 employees of H&R Block. They have to comply with these laws, wage definition laws in a lot of the states, I assume. Do they do it any differently in any other states than they do it here?
No. In fact, there are 80,000 tax professionals in 2006, about the same number in 2007 that H&R Block calculated the end-of-season pay for. And I'm not sure it's in the record. There may be special situations in California, but I'm not sure about that.
But those 80,000, there's about 1,300 of those people are in Indiana.
Yes.
The rest are all over.
Yes, yes. And it's the same system that's used for everybody, no matter where they are throughout the United States. Okay. And notably, the company calculates 80,000 the pay for 80,000 people, but only around 60,000 of them receive end-of-season compensation, which suggests that it's not based on the hours worked, and it is in addition to the pay that they receive. There are no more questions from the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Story. Mr. Weldy.
Judge Evans, I want to address that question that you just posed to her. H&R Block made a decision to do business in the state of Indiana, and as part of that, they agreed to abide by the laws of the state of Indiana. And one of the things that I've made a point of stating over and over and over again is that when asked how quickly could they have calculated this end-of-season compensation for the 1,400 people at issue for the state of Indiana, they couldn't respond. They could only give me what their schedule was on a national basis. And if they want to do business in the state of Indiana, I think they have to take into consideration what time dictates Indiana law requires. And I don't think that the fact that they are a national company precludes them from doing that. Your Honor, one factual thing.
Could they decide to not make any end-of-season pay to Indiana H&R Block contract people?
Then I wouldn't be suing them, Your Honor, and that would be fine. I would presume that they would pay them more hourly wages, so people would probably end up pretty good, Your Honor. One factual thing I want to address, because I think there was a misstatement by H&R Block. According to the record, and this is in Judge Hamilton's opinion at page 5 and 6, payroll processing was completed within 2 days after the end of the payroll of the tax season. So April 21st, 2006 was the end of the tax season. According to their deponent, payroll processes was completed by H&R Block April 23rd of 06, and likewise 2 days later for 07. Unless there's any other questions, that's all my time.
Thank you, Weldy. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court